From California to New York, Nebraska to North Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, David Keene, a lion of the conservative movement, has passed away. John Gizzi of Newsmax joins us for a remembrance. A special congressional election in Georgia has resulted in a runoff. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Tad DeHaven of the Cato Institute about the Trump administration's efforts to get commerce flowing again through the Strait of Hormuz. And he hit the only walk-off home run ever to win baseball's World Series. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary on the life and career of Bill Mazeroski. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. He was one of the founding fathers of the modern conservative movement. David Keene passed away this past week. To learn more about his life and its impact, we turn to John Gizzi. John is a columnist and White House correspondent for Newsmax. John, welcome back to American Radio Journal. John, David Keene is someone that those of us who have been involved in the national conservative movement for a very long time, we know him. We know him well. We know the impact he has had. But for most Americans, he's probably the most influential conservative they have never heard of. So tell us, who was David Keene? And upon his passing, why should we take note of this?
David Keene was someone who was never granted elective office. He never had a weekly television show, a talk radio show, and it was only late in life that his byline began to appear in his twilight position as opinion editor of the Washington Times. And yet, he was as important to the conservative movement as de Gaulle was in French politics from the end of World War II till he finally became the president of France in the new Fifth Republic nearly 14 years later. As influential an insider as there was, he was there for the founding of the Young Americans for Freedom. He was its national chairman while an undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin. He was the assistant for Vice President Spiro Agnew, whom he loved, and was laying the groundwork for a presidential bid until the vice president got into some trouble and was forced to resign. Executive assistant to Senator James Buckley, the last person to win a Senate seat, running on neither major party ticket but the conservative party ticket in New York. Dave Keene was an operative with Ronald Reagan, with George H.W. Bush, and Bob Dole in all their presidential campaigns. He was chairman of American Conservative Union for more than 20 years, president of the National Rifle Association for a two-year term, and as I mentioned, the opinion editor of the Washington Times. That's more than half a century behind the scenes in politics. And David could be gruff at times. He could be a little impatient with people who disagreed with him, but he was always a gentleman. And I speak of people who disagreed with David. Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, Tennessee Senator Lamar Alexander, were people he dined with regularly. And they are not exactly part of the post-war conservative or right-of-center movement. And I would say this, if you go back to the Goldwater days and end up in the Trump days, you see David Keene there in some capacity, mostly behind the scenes, sometimes out front being interviewed. But he was a major factor.
We are, of course, in an era now, John, where Donald Trump and a more populist brand of conservatism is in the ascendancy. But talk a little bit about David Keene. And if you go back to the Ronald Reagan, William F. Buckley type of conservatism that was dominant through the 1980s into the 1990s, David was a big part of that, was he not?
He certainly was. And when he was in college, reading the works of the economist Ludwig von Mises and the importance of freedom had a profound impact on him. And if you listen to him talk about those days, like Goldwater, like Reagan, like Buckley, freedom was the theme through all of his remarks, all of his readings, and anything he discussed at the time. I might add, Dr. Walter Judd, a medical missionary who later served as a Republican House member from Minnesota, had done missionary work in China, and he became a fearsome anti-communist, and his words had a big impact on David. I remember watching David speak when I went to Dr. Judd's funeral, and I could see that he was clearly a disciple. So the issues were different then. The people stylistically were different from those we see as conservative leaders today. But David Keene was right there with them.
And of course, one of his enduring legacies, John, is the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC. You have been around for most, if not all, of CPAC's history. That conference really was the place to be for many decades, and David Keene was part of it, correct? Actually, wasn't part of it. He was really the conductor of the orchestra.
He certainly was, and he made CPAC revive and run hard. In the early 60s, the Human Events Conference, named after the publication I worked for many years, captivated conservatives, and it was held in Washington and drew a huge crowd from around the country. In 1964, its organizers decided not to have a third Human Events Conference because coming right after John Kennedy's death, they thought that it would not go over that well. Of course, 64 was the year Barry Goldwater took over the Republican Party and made conservatism walk. So I would say in retrospect, they were wrong. Fast forward ahead to 7 years later, 1971, Dave Keene and others said it was time to revive this conference, but to bring in all kinds of conservatives, anti-communists, economic conservatives, libertarians, and the growing but still small cultural conservative movement, the religious right. Well, David and others gathered them together in Washington, most often at the Washington Hilton, and it drew big crowds. A regular speaker every year without hesitation, before and during his presidency, Ronald Reagan.
And now, of course, that conference does continue. David Keene, a lion of the conservative movement. John, you wrote a very touching tribute to him in Newsmax. I want to tell our listeners where they can go to read that.
You can read my tribute to David Keene. Go to newsmax.com, www.newsmax.com. Look up John Gizzi on politics, and you'll see it.
John Gizzi of Newsmax. John, as always, we appreciate your being with us. Thank you. Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We've had a number of major developments, a special election, movement in a couple of U.S. Senate seats. We're going to get all the details now from Scott Parkinson. Scott, good to have you here.
It's my pleasure.
In the Peach State of Georgia, there was a special election in a congressional district, and we now are headed to a runoff. Scott, give us a little bit of background as to why there's a special election and where do things go from here?
I think a lot of the listeners remember that Marjorie Taylor Greene decided after President Trump and her had a pretty big public spat that she would not seek re-election. And she ended up submitting her papers to the clerk of the House in early January, retiring early, and setting up this special election that occurred last Tuesday. The interesting thing in this race was President Trump did weigh in and offered his complete and total endorsement for a Republican district attorney named Clayton Fuller. And there was also a state senator in the race, another Republican, Colton Moore, who has a lot of grassroots support and is sort of known as a firebrand in that area. So everybody's kind of watching closely. What does the Trump endorsement mean in a district that Marjorie was incredibly popular in? And she didn't come out for any of the candidates. But ultimately, what happened was it's what's known as a jungle runoff, meaning Republicans, Democrats, and independents are all on the ballot at the same time. And 17 candidates ended up keeping their name on the ballot. And the funny enough thing is that a Democrat, Sean Harris, finished in first place with 37.3% of the vote. But that's far underneath 50% of the vote, which is what you would need to avoid a runoff. And Clayton Fuller finished just a couple thousand votes behind him with 34.9%. Colton Moore, the state senator that I referenced, finished in third place with 11.6%. But I mean, you had people out of 115,000 votes. Some of these people received under 300 votes. Most of them received underneath 1,000 votes. So it was really consolidated support, mostly among Sean Harris, the Democrat, Clayton Fuller, the Republican, who advances to the runoff, and Colton Moore. And I'm very confident, I could say this today, that Colton Moore is going to be the next U.S. representative in the 14th Congressional District once that runoff election is completed.
Switching gears here now to the United States Senate, Senator Mark Wayne Mullen of the great state of Oklahoma has been tabbed by President Trump to become the new Secretary of Homeland Security. Talk a little bit about how that came about. And assumedly, Oklahoma is a safe seat for Republicans, but what is the process there going forward?
Oklahoma is a pretty red state, and we have two current Republican senators. Mark Wayne Mullen is still in the Senate, still voting, but he has been nominated by President Trump to be the next Secretary of Homeland Security as the president reassigned Secretary Kristi Noem. The interesting thing about Oklahoma is they have statute that says if you are appointed to be U.S. Senator by the governor, you can't run for a full term. You can only fill out the remainder of that year. So whoever Governor Kevin Stitt appoints will not be on the ballot in the primary this June. And so you've got a bunch of names that are sort of kicking the tires on whether or not they're going to run. Other people, I think, know that they can't win a U.S. Senate primary against some of these top-tier candidates, and they're putting their name forward to be a U.S. senator for, honestly, like 8 months. And so it's kind of interesting to watch all this unfold. U.S. representative from, I believe, the first congressional district of Oklahoma is Kevin Hearn. And Kevin Hearn owned a bunch of McDonald's. He's been a really successful entrepreneur, and he's going to self-fund his U.S. Senate race in a big way. And he's obviously been fantastic in the House, has a great score on the Club for Growth Economic Scorecard. And we're also watching closely to see what Governor Stitt decides to do. The Club for Growth issued a new poll. We went into the field immediately after the Mark Wayne Mullen announcement, and we came out with polling that showed Kevin Hearn leading head-to-head against Kevin Stitt and then also head-to-head against another U.S. representative, Stephanie Bice. That's going to be an interesting race to watch. We'll see how President Trump feels about the candidates as well, but I think it's going to be Kevin Hearn in the end of the day that probably pulls that one out. Obviously, that's a pretty early prediction, and anything can happen in politics, as you know.
It certainly does. And assumedly, Senator Mark Wayne Mullen will become the newest member of President Trump's cabinet. Now, in Montana, of all places, we had an unexpected U.S. senatorial surprise. What happened there?
Yeah, Montana Senator Steve Daines announced he would not seek re-election in 2026. And you might remember in 2020, former Montana governor ran against Daines, and it was a really costly, expensive, close race. Just recently, Tim Sheehy defeated John Tester, a Democrat. So sometimes the state goes back and forth, as odd as it sounds, because Montana is a safe seat for Republicans in the presidential cycles. What can happen in a midterm? Well, Steve Daines waited until 8 minutes before the filing deadline, and then he withdrew his paperwork for reelection. And what they did was they coordinated with another candidate that was sort of the handpicked guy from Governor Greg Gianforte and Steve Daines. And his name is Kurt Almy. And Kurt is currently an American U.S. attorney who has only been in the position about a year. And prior to that, he served in state government, has been the director of Montana's Governor's Office of Budget and Programming.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, a few words about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. Today, we talked about some of the candidates that are running for the United States Senate. We talked about that special election in Georgia. But if you want to learn more about all the candidates that the club is supporting for 2026, visit us at clubforgrowth.org, where you can sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
The Strait of Hormuz is one of the most vital shipping lanes in the world. It has been disrupted by the conflict with Iran. To talk about the Trump administration's efforts to get traffic flowing again, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Tad DeHaven of the Cato Institute.
We are just about 2 weeks into the war or conflict with Iran, and one of the big developments so far in the war has been the difficulty in getting tankers and other ships through the Strait of Hormuz. That's the key shipping channel that connects the Persian Gulf and all of the oil that comes from it to the Indian Ocean and the rest of the world. In the early days of the conflict, President Donald Trump floated an idea to have the U.S. Development Finance Corporation back an insurance plan for ships that would be moving through the strait, but that so far doesn't seem to be working, quite frankly. And part of the complication there might be the fact that the U.S. Development Finance Corp has never done something like this before. In fact, it looks like this is a situation where the Trump administration is kind of grasping for a solution after it had already created quite a bit of a mess. It is a situation that my guest today describes as government by improvisation, and I think that's a pretty useful phrase to sum up not just this situation, but honestly so much of what we've seen from the second Trump administration in the past year or so. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. That aforementioned guest is Tad DeHaven. He is a policy analyst at the Cato Institute, and he joins us now on the phone. Tad, thanks so much for taking some time with us. Glad to talk to you here. You're a fellow Pennsylvanian. We go way back.
Eric, it's always great to be on with my fellow Pennsylvanian.
Obviously, we should say up front here, look, we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon, and war is crazy. Things can change quickly by the time people are hearing this. Circumstances may have changed, but as of this moment, just give us a quick update on the current situation in the Strait of Hormuz.
So we're now 11 days in since the joint attack by the United States and Israel on Iran. And the Strait of Hormuz, which is arguably the most critical global trade choke point in the world, is effectively shut down. It's been shut down. And I'm reading today that there's three tankers have been attacked and are on fire. And on top of that, there is oil exports going out. It's just that it's Iran's exports. And in fact, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that Iran is now exporting more oil than it did before the onset of hostilities.
So Trump has suggested using this thing called the U.S. Development Finance Corporation to cover up to $20 billion in shipping insurance, basically, or like reinsurance for ships that might end up kind of caught in the crossfire here in the strait. And so far, is this plan working?
That the president felt compelled, I believe about 4 days after the onset of hostilities, he took to his True Social and made a very grand claim that the U.S. government was going to ensure all maritime trade and get everything flowing again. I immediately saw that, and we'll talk about it later, but it sort of comports with standing operating procedure under the president and under this administration, where he promises, you know, it makes these big grandiose claims and things like that. But when the rubber meets the road, it's either untenable, it's not lawful, it's not constitutional. And then you see an improvisation by the administrative staff trying to get it to go. And so you can say that they're going to go do this stuff, but of the details that we've gotten from DFC, pointing to a much limited, much more narrow reinsurance program that they're trying to run through American insurers. And if you read the commentary from the analysts to people in the shipping industry, the insurance industry, everybody's saying the same thing. It's not a matter of the insurance so much as it is a matter of safety. And on that, the administration has no answer, because we don't even know what the true objective of this entire military operation is. And I think you can make a case that they don't know either.
Yeah, I mean, it seems clear to me that, like, obviously the United States militarily can overwhelm Iran. That's not a bit of question really ever. But the fact that we, 2 weeks into the war here, really don't have control over this vital shipping lane in the Strait of Hormuz obviously speaks to the fact that the Iranian defenses are perhaps a bit stronger than we may have anticipated. We're chatting with Tad DeHaven from the Cato Institute here. Tad, you wrote a piece this week that people can find at cato.org, in which you wrote about this, you know, this whole insurance situation and the shipping situation in the Strait of Hormuz, and you described this as a government by improvisation. And I thought that was a pretty useful phrase to describe, as you say in the piece, not just this, but there's sort of this pattern in the Trump administration of not necessarily lining up solutions ahead of time, but just sort of, this is maybe putting too blunt a point on it, but sort of making it up as they go.
Well, Eric, that's the fact. I mean, it is making it up as you go along. Look, that's the point. Over and over and over again, Trump makes these big, grandiose claims about he's going to do this and he's going to do that, and he touts these huge headlines of Japan's giving me $550 billion, and my favorite is that my tariffs have resulted in $18 trillion in investment. But when you look at the actual facts, they're at odds with reality. And his administration that he has surrounded himself with, they know that. And it's their job to go out and, like I said, improvise and concoct something that plausibly passes legal and constitutional muster, but is far removed from everything that the president claimed he was going to do or is doing.
We're running out of time here, Tad, so we'll have to leave it there. But I do want to direct people once again to the piece you wrote this week at cato.org. Folks can find that there. Trump's war insurance decree follows predictable pattern. That's the headline on that piece from Tad DeHaven at the Cato Institute. Tad, thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you, Eric. Great to be on.
For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out our ongoing coverage of the war in Iran, along with everything else going on around the country this week, at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
It is known as the shot heard around the world. Bill Mazeroski's walk-off home run to win the 1960 World Series for the Pittsburgh Pirates. He passed away recently, and Dr. Paul Kengor, editor-in-chief of the American Spectator, offers a remembrance on this American Radio Journal commentary.
2 weeks ago, I awoke at the Oaklander Hotel on the campus of the University of Pittsburgh, a night away from the kids with my wife. It was ironic. From my window, I could see the William Pitt Student Union, where my wife and I met in 1989. I could also see Hines Chapel, where we got married in May 1993. It sits next to the majestic Cathedral of Learning. I could also see the spot where the greatest home run in the history of baseball was hit on October 13, 1960, by Pittsburgh Pirates second baseman Bill Mazeroski in the bottom of the ninth inning against the New York Yankees. It was Game 7. Maz's shot won the World Series as the ball sailed over the head of another future Hall of Famer, Yankees legend Yogi Berra, who wasn't the catcher for that game. The image of Maz's hit flying past the 14-foot Longines clock above the wall at storied Forbes Field is iconic. as is the sight of him circling the bases, waving his hat in joy. To this day, it sounds like millions rather than thousands of people from Pittsburgh and Western Pennsylvania were at that game. But of course, that wasn't possible. Forbes Field, which was one of those sacred shrines of baseball that isn't there anymore, held only about 36,000 fans. Two of my uncles happened to be there. Most people tuned in via radio or TV, and not just in Pittsburgh and New York. That game had a huge national audience. That 1960 World Series was quite a ride. The Yankees team vastly outscored the Bucks overall, trouncing them in blowouts in the three games that the Yankees won. They had players like Yogi Berra, Roger Maris, Mickey Mantle, pitcher Whitey Ford, and coach Casey Stengel. Of course, the Pirates were no slouches. A fellow Hall of Famer on Maz's team was a guy named Roberto Clemente. The team was loaded with stars, including the National League's MVP that year, Dick Groat, who also had been a standout in basketball, an All-American at Duke. But though the Yanks outscored the Bucks overall, the latter won the requisite four games out of seven, thanks to Mazeroski's shot heard around the world in the ninth inning of Game 7. It remains, to this day, the only walk-off home run to win a World Series in Game 7. After Mazeroski retired at the end of the 1972 season, playing all of his 17th season with the Bucks, an intense debate commenced over whether he merited being inducted into the Hall of Fame. The problem for Maz, which is ironic given that he was known for the greatest home run ever, was his offensive numbers. They were good but not great, though admittedly they were hampered by the massive 400-foot-plus distance of the Forbes Field left center wall. Even then, he did retire with 138 home runs and over 2,000 hits. However, his defensive production was extraordinary, even unsurpassed, and made him a seven-time All-Star. Maz's ability to turn a double play was picturesque perfect. He holds the all-time record for double plays turned by a second baseman. When he retired, no player ever had as many double plays. Conservative columnist and baseball pontificator George Will argued that if baseball was merely about offense, then pitchers shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. Defensive greatness ought to count. Will argued that Hall of Fame voters were guilty of discrimination against defensemen. When you combine Mazeroski's phenomenal Gold Glove numbers with respectable offensive numbers atop the 1960 home run, he deserved a spot in the Hall. And indeed, just that finally happened in the year 2001. Mazeroski's speech at that induction ceremony in Cooperstown was quite the display. The humble local kid was so nervous and so emotional that he couldn't get through his text and finally said something like, "Forget about this crap," and sat down to laughs and thunderous applause. I say all of this now because William Stanley Mazeroski passed away on February 20th, that weekend that I spent at the Oaklander Hotel. He passed away at his home, far removed from the wall of Forbes Field where he launched that baseball on October 13, 1960. Like the wall that remains on the Oakland campus today, Maz will always remain in the hearts of the people of the Pittsburgh region. But not only in Pittsburgh. Fans nationwide watched in awe and cheered as Maz and the underdog Bucks defeated the mighty Yankees. May Bill Mazeroski rest in peace. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KXBR-FM in International Falls, Minnesota, KTIA-FM in Des Moines, Iowa, along with WWSM-AM in Lebanon, Pennsylvania. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the cost of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guest and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.